I enjoy life and growth. My tribe is those like you who are constantly improving. The people who listen to this podcast are the people in life who want to do better and be better. If you are this type of person, I recommend you visit leaderbits.io, which is a company that I started that is dedicated to helping you grow as a technology leader. The best part is if you want to improve, we will have your company pay for it for you. So just reach out and we'll take care of the rest. Leaderbits.io. Today we are talking to Mitch Van Dyne, the founder and CTO of Catprint, and we discuss creating community environment at work, bringing up developers within your company, and Mitch's claim to fame with a contribution to modern computing. All of this right here, right now on the Modern CTO Podcast.
Here we go.
This is the Modern CTO Podcast.
He was asking if you 3D printed cats, right?
No, we can't figure out 3D printing yet because we don't know how we would get the jobs because people don't have the technology to create the artwork to print.
Well, I thought you guys could just say that you 3D print cats and then you would just go put out a food bowl somewhere and just find the cat that looks closest to the one they wanted and just ship that cat.
Nice. Well, we have. I mean, we have cats in the customer service offices. The customer service manager is very involved in animal rescue, and so we almost always have one or two rescue cats who are waiting for a permanent home, hanging around in customer service. They really wouldn't do well on the factory floor, but they hang around over there. So we have a kind of a wall of all these cats that we've taken care of, and the customers really love that. You know, we advertise it on, and we actually, you know, invite people to make donations towards the animal rescue shelter and stuff. So people get into that a lot.
Oh, nice. My wife has been a vet tech for about a decade. So she's always around the animals, and we have three dogs, but we don't have any cats.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we had four cats when we started the business. We started in our basement. And they got into things, you know, they were running around and now we're down to zero cats. And we had a cat for a short while and we discovered that we were kind of allergic to them, you know, very mildly, but we just sort of, until we're so old that we can't have a dog, we'll probably just keep dogs instead of cats for now.
That's exactly why I don't have a cat. And well, it's one of those things where I'm very allergic to the cats, right? So, and then some dogs, but not all dogs. So what happens is you can't get close to something or really experience it if you can't be around it because it causes you pain.
Right.
Right. Exactly. So it's like I've never bonded with a cat because I can't get close to cats. I just have to stay away from them.
Right. Right. So it'd be tough. And we have to ask that when we interview, you know, that our people, because we have our dogs and employees' dogs come to work, and so, you know, an interview question is, you know, are you violently allergic to animals? Because if you are, you're probably going to be tough working here.
That's not something your insurance covers. Yeah,
right. Exactly.
Now Amazon has like the whole dogs of Amazon, and then do you put that on your website too? Like, here are the cats of, you know, Catprint.
Yeah. So the cats, you know, because they come and go, they are. You know, we'll like show, here's our newest, not so much on the website, but on the social media, you know, like on the Instagram and Facebook feeds, we'll, you know, celebrate the cat getting their forever home, as it's called. So the cats, that kind of how they work. And the dogs, though, they are sort of employees. You know, sometimes, I don't know, we're redoing the employee profile pages, but I'm sure when we get done redoing, there'll be a, you know, we'll treat each of the dogs as an employee and have them on there.
That's exciting.
We try to have fun with it.
Well, that's what it's, I mean, that's the human element, and that's what makes the work worth doing, is getting to explore that human part of it too.
Yeah. We were just talking, we just had our annual, you know, information share with the entire cast and afterwards, the three partners, my wife and the CFO, John, and I were talking about it. And the thing is, in today's world, you're at work 8+ hours a day. And it's your community.
Right.
And it's for a lot of people, they don't have big families anymore, you know, and they don't have, you don't get community from your family. You're at work. So work should be a place where you can make friends and you do feel comfortable and you feel like it's a community. So we try hard to do that and encourage that. And I think it works. I think people are happy.
How big is your community currently?
28 employees, 29. I think we just talked 28.
Mm-hmm. So about 28, 29 cat printers.
Yep.
Is that exactly what you guys call each other?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's so exciting. And then is your site actually written in your Hyperloop that you made?
It is.
Ooh.
But quite an old version. So, you know, Hyperloop is a moving target. We're trying to get 1.0 out, the Hyperloop team, and getting pretty close to that. But, you know, cat print is like on a real, like probably 2-year-old iteration of it. And so we have a staging area where we're integrating, you know, all the latest changes. The trouble is there's been a lot of deprecations. And so I had to get through all those breakages and fix stuff. But I think probably within a month, it'll be full Hyperloop.
Nice.
Yeah.
Was that Elon Musk inspired naming?
Yes, it was. It was definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you see the kind of the fun pun there, but it's like the rails of the 21st century.
I love it. I thought it was really interesting when I was going through it. It kind of like stretched my mind quite a bit.
Yeah, that's one of the harder things that we've had about getting people to understand is it in a sense is so simple. But if you say, well, how does that actually work? It kind of is mind blowing. And then so people get confused and they think, well, that couldn't possibly work that way. And so people on the chat area will be having these elaborate hunks of code. And it's like, no, you just write this one line. And they're like, how does that even happen?
So, you're like magic. That's your answer.
Yeah. Well, it is some and that's the kind of the magic, you know, back in, you know, 90, whatever it was, 93 or 4, when, you know, that was the magic of Rails, right? So it's kind of that's our hope is that we can take that to the next quantum level.
Well, that's a really good point you just brought up. Like, at first, when you started using Rails, it was like magic. You're like, whoa. And that was the same thing when I saw Hyperloop. I was like, that's unbelievable. How is that happening? And it takes a while to get a collection of people to become used to something, to get comfortable with it.
Right. And then the other problem we have is that, you know, we're in a sense competing. I don't know, competing is not quite the right word, but if you didn't use Hyperloop, what would you do? Well, you'd probably use React and JavaScript and that whole thing, right? And, mm-hmm. and if you look at that world, I am constantly amazed by what people put up with in terms of difficulty. You know, just the amount of boilerplate code you have to do. And I'm mentoring a young man who's you know, wants to be a software developer, and he's going through some boot camps and stuff. I meet with him once a week and go over any questions he has. And I look at this coursework in JavaScript and going, you know, and I just bite my tongue and I help him through it. But I'm like, that has got to be the hardest thing in the world to do. Just to like say, hello world. I'm like generating all this code and all this crap to put this thing together. So we kind of compete with that because the expectation is, well, I'm going to have to do all that stuff. And you go, no, you actually just add this gem to your Rails app. And
yeah.
Start writing code. And they're going, yeah, but where does this go? Where does this thing go? We don't need that thing anymore. Where's my controller? Well, what does a controller really do for you? You know, there's no functional, the customer isn't paying you for a controller. You know, they want to pay for you to have this button place an order. So let's get all the other stuff that doesn't help you with that process out of the way. So,
yeah, that's like, I encourage everybody to go check it out. It's Ruby Hyperloop, right?
Yeah, ruby-hyperloop.org. Yeah.
Yeah. It was unbelievably interesting. And it had a lot of resources around it too, which is always like extraordinarily useful.
Yeah. We've got I think I mentioned there's a guy, Barry Hadfield, who is he's a real CTO. I was talking about doing this podcast with you guys, and the CFO said, well, yeah, you're not really the CTO. You're like the principal scientist of CatPrint, which is closer to the truth of it. You know, I have 9 patents and that's kind of my gig. But there's a guy, Barry Hadfield, and he's a real CTO and he's much more successful than I am. I think, I don't know, he's on his third or fourth iteration of companies and they're, you know, do very well. And he's betting his next business on Hyperloop. He's developing it all in Hyperloop. And he's responsible for the name, actually. We were kicking this around a couple of years ago and he says, well, how about Hyperloop?
What's his project now?
Well, I think you should talk to him about that.
What world is it in? Is it in the cat world or the camel world? Or
I think it's to do with nonprofit enablement. I mean, his previous project was, or the one he's still like the CTO of this thing, of this firm that they're trying to, whatever you do, sell it or whatever you do, whatever you call that.
Exit.
That's the word I was looking for. They're trying to, they're getting ready to exit. And that has to do, I think it's like a Google Docs, sort of an enterprise Google Docs type system. But I had spoken to him and he'd love to talk to you guys. And I think you'd get a real, you get a real CTO out of that. So
I consider you a real CTO, by the way.
I don't know. All that internet plumbing and stuff like that. I just call it, it's just plumbing. Just call the plumbers and fix this thing,
Yeah, I love this perspective. I love when I run into people that have unique, different perspectives. It's definitely a treat talking with you.
now, I will say one of the reasons I can say that, and I guess this is sort of a CTO decision, right? Is I made a commitment back when we were quite a bit smaller, but probably goes back 7 years ago. And I said, we will never, ever have another server in my business. Everything is on the cloud. And that was before the cloud was really like it is now. Because we had bought this server and it paid like $10,000, which was at that time was a big purchase for us. And it just never did us a bit of good. It was just a nightmare. And the whole thing, I said, never, ever again. It's all on. And so everything we do is online. Accounting, we use QuickBooks. HR, we use Bamboo. And, of course, the Rails app is, it's on. It's served off the cloud. And but even when it comes down to machinery and production, obviously some machinery that's touching like motors and stuff. And so it has to have a PC. But what we do is we download. We deploy off the cloud and download into a Electron app. So it's also written in Hyperloop. So we download into an Electron app, and then that then can touch, motors and servos and USB ports and stuff like that.
And how many developers do you currently have on your team?
Well, we're up to 5, not including me. That's a pretty rapid. This is like we went from 2 to 5 in just a couple of months here. So it's kind of a new for us.
Exciting though, and they're all helping progress Hyperloop too, right?
Yeah, exactly. And two of those 5 are cat coders, they're apprentices. So 2 of them had no development experience, and one of them came from production. Oh, both of them came from production. One has a high school education, but was interested in being a developer. And we have a policy that if you want to learn to be a developer, you can take some tests and do some work on your own. And if it looks like you're good, we'll put you on half-time, train you, and after about 6 months to a year, bring you in full-time as a developer.
That's awesome. You have a little recruiting pipeline right in your business.
Yeah, and it's good for them. You take people that have the talent and you give them an opportunity. It's going to be a much more interesting job for them. They know the business. Like both those guys, they know how production works. So when we need a new feature that's going to help the production floor, they know what it means. They know what it's about.
Ooh, that's more businesses should deploy a program like that.
It's pretty easy and it's predictable. It works. Yeah. You have to work it, but it works. And we recently just hired 3 college grads that just graduated. And one guy actually finished his degree while working here, but he was well on the way. That was a funny thing because he still had a couple of classes to take. So the last class he had to take was on web development. So he's sitting here writing in Hyperloop, right? And he's going back to school at night and they're teaching him PHP and HTML. He said it's the most frustrating, you know, it's the most frustrating 13 weeks of his life. So.
Well, the good thing is when you get these people fresh or you recruit from within, or, you know, I don't know, recruits, like, I don't like the sound of the word. When you pull people up from within, right?
Yeah.
Then you don't have to spend all the time dealing with all their bad habits, right? That they picked up from other places. Yeah. You kind of get to teach them fresh.
Right. I would be, yes, you're right. I mean, these guys that have college degrees, they seem to be working out great, but they're brand new out of college.
Right.
So they haven't gotten any craziness yet.
Well, with college, I like to say it's an expensive piece of paper that says you could do things you don't necessarily want to do.
I guess.
Right. So if they have that mentality to go study and pass the test, and the reason why I say that is this, is because no matter what your passion is, right, you have to take classes that don't relate to your passion in order to get the degree. So by definition, everyone who has this degree, in my opinion, is they have the ability to make themselves study and learn things that they don't want to learn. Right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. That's not a bad trait.
Right. That's true. That's a good point. There's some. Yeah, that's a very good point.
A lot of people who will not learn something they don't want to learn.
And a lot of times those classes that maybe you didn't want to take in the end, you know, I have a degree in comp sci way back. Mm-hmm. Way back when, before there were computers. I mean, my first programming class was on punch cards.
Nice. Did you stand in line to get them run?
Exactly. Yeah. You stood in line to run the punch cards, and then you came back the next day to see if your program ran.
Well, I remember hearing a book from Martin, I think it was Martin Fowler. I was reading one of his books, and he's talking about how he'd write the code, and then they would get on a plane, and they would fly across the United States to go run the test.
Right. So when I went to college, one class, though, that I think outside of the core, you know, comp sci classes, and some of that stuff I still, you know, sticks with you. But outside of that, I think every day about the things I learned in the anthropology class, you know, just how human beings organize and behave and the commonalities that we have. I think about that all the time. And I wouldn't have taken that class, except, you know, you had to take a certain number of electives in the humanities department. So
what are your patents in? Like, what area are your patents in?
They're almost all in software algorithms. I worked at Xerox for many years. Starting as an engineer and then as a manager, you know, it's the usual corporate thing. The only way to really pay the bills is to move up into management and talk about doing what you don't want to do. Oh my gosh, it's the worst. But, you know, just the politics and the big company bureaucracy is insane. I think about what we get done here at a small company compared to how big companies work. It's insane.
Luckily, I haven't ever actually worked as an employee inside of a big company. Because I've always done my own thing, right? Because my dad freelance made technology. So I went right there and then started my own technology company, just taking on clients. But when I had to work with the large clients, like I remember when I got one of my first Fortune 500 clients, I was just like floored by the amount of money they spend and how slow they move.
It's amazing.
Unbelievable. I was like, you guys realize we could just make a decision and do it. We can just do it. We could just say, let's try these two things and do them like real quick and see which one works better.
Right.
Like, no.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, like Hyperloop, the name was, we kind of, you know, there was all these gems that were kind of coalescing together, you know, and they had names like Reactive Record, which is actually pretty cute, you know.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And Reactive Record, and then there was React RB, and there was, you know, so I don't know what else, but it just we needed a single name, and we were just kind of kicking it around, and Barry suggested on the chat Hyperloop, and a couple of people said that's cool, you know, and then people said, you know, it's this pun to it, it just works really well. It also works well architecturally, because, you know, what you're constantly doing is using push from the server, you're basically closing the loop. So you're constantly looping the data between the server and the clients. So it just works on any number of levels. And so, you know, I went on, I got the domain name, and I said, okay, name's changed. We're going to call it. And I went in and, you know, took all the gems and renamed them and redeployed them. It's like Barry said, that was the fastest name change I ever saw. Well, that's what you could do. It's what you can do when you're small, right? So.
Right. You got to find and replace.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in this thing that you're doing about bringing up your developers within. I have a couple questions about that. Are you noticing when you're bringing these people up, do you have any issues with like spaghetti code or indentation or properly naming of functions? Like how do those things come up? How do you handle them? What are you noticing in those areas with these people that don't have experience and you're pulling them up inside your company?
Yeah, there's two different levels of that question, right? There's two different levels of that problem. The base level is super easy fixed by RuBuCop, right?
Mm-hmm.
So RuBuCop solves that. You just say you don't check in code that doesn't follow, you know, the RuBuCop standard. And then what's it called on the when you run it in the CI server? It's basically it's all the RuBuCop rules up there, and then it gives you a grade. So you don't check in code that doesn't get an A. So that takes care of all the, you know, the sort of the lower level syntactic issues around that, right? And then you get into the this is the hardest thing to teach anybody is how do you teach good architecture? I mean, that's a lifelong, you know, I'm constantly refactoring chunks of Hyperloop because I go, what was I even thinking when I wrote that code? It's like,
right.
I mean, how much beer did I actually have when I wrote that code? It's like, it's insane. So you constantly, and sometimes I think that's really, that's the only, there is no good architecture. There's just a willingness to refactor your code. And there is a, if you rely on test specs, if you say, look, what I'm really going to do is, I'm not like a test-driven development Nazi, like I wouldn't insist.
Right, me either.
You got to write the test spec first, but I would say you got to write the test spec somewhere in the process. And if you've got the specs to go with the code and you feel really like you got solid specs, then you have the freedom to at any time say, all right, I'm spending too much time in this module. It's too hard to make changes here. This needs to be redone. And if you've got a good, healthy set of specs, then you can say, okay, I can take the risk of refactoring this stuff. And when you do that, then you learn and evolve. And then I think in your own learning, you say, yeah, that was a better way to do it. But that's the only way I can think about software architecture. It's not like building architecture. You're constrained by these laws of physics to what's going to work and what's not going to work. But in software, we're so flexible and open. There's so many new ideas that come along, you know, and
It's a story. I mean, you can go back and rewrite your story a million times, tell it slightly different. Anyone can have a different perspective of it and inject stuff different places. It's so tough, like to put concrete items in place and say, right, this is how it's done. Like RuBuCop is a great answer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to me, that's just a joy to like not have to worry about, to have something else just saying, you just type, Adam just says red flag, and you go, what's that? And then you learn things. I learn Ruby from RuBuCop because it'll be like saying, don't do this. And you go, well, how do you want me to do it? And then you look, you know, you look the little link in it and you Google it a bit and you go, oh, wow, I didn't know there was this operator, you know? And
right.
But to me, the interacting with that whole thing, especially for my life, you know, to have started on punch cards and to have actually taken classes where you would talk about, well, this is the algorithm that we could use to like graphically display stuff if we ever had a processor fast enough to display it, right? And this
right.
is how you could actually have a dynamic compiler and a dynamic language and stuff. If we ever have a computer that has enough processing power to do that type of dynamic type checking and stuff. And then to kind of go through it and to be then in a world where all that stuff not only exists, but then people are writing it as a community. And, you know, here's Adam, the world's best editor. I mean, I'm not saying it is the world's best, but it's a beautiful editor, right?
Compared to, I use currently.
Compared to what I was using 30 years ago, right? And it's free, and people are contributing it for to help each other. And, you know, they're growing their own business with it. And it's just exciting. It's just a beautiful thing.
Thank you, Chris, right? Chris Warnsworth, he's like awesome.
And it's, yeah, that whole thing. And then RuboCop's the same way. Well, why do we have it, right? And that's my biggest hope with Hyperloop is I would love to give back in some way and just say thank you. Because I couldn't have this business without Rails. And I suppose there might be something else, an alternative, but I couldn't have this business without all the open source software that it depends on.
You ever write out to DHH or Freed or any of those people?
No, maybe I should. Do you think I should? I don't know.
We know them. Yeah. Like we had Ryan Singer. It's a Ryan and DHH and Jason are the three people that run Basecamp, and he was on the show.
I mean, I could send him a note and say, hey,
send him an email. They're like totally cool people.
Yeah. I mean, all we see, we see his tweets once in a while and sometimes, whatever.
They're people, man. They like a good line dropped on them, right? Like, thanks, man. He'd be like, no problem. You're awesome.
Yeah. All right. Well, I should do it. I should do that.
Yeah.
Thanks. That's a good, good suggestion.
Now, do other languages have RuboCop the way Ruby does?
Well, it wouldn't be called RuboCop, right? It'd be called...
It'd
be called, you know, choke your... I won't say that. I was about to say something you had to take off the air. But... I mean, what would the Python equivalent of RuboCop be?
I don't know.
You could have a lot of fun with that. And
right.
And Go, I guess Go could be stoplight, you know?
Oh, man, this is so, what a boring name. I just Googled it real quick. I like, first of all, Go stoplight is not what I was saying boring name to. That's awesome. No. I like that. But this Python has a package called Code Validator 0.8.2. Come on. Where's the branding on that?
It's to me, that's an amazing thing about, you know, Python and Ruby, because they are at some level very similar, right? And very similar causes and why they exist in the world. But then if you take the differences in the language and map those to the difference in the personalities of the guys behind them, right? It maps perfectly.
Culture,
Just look at, if you look at the Wikipedia articles on, you know, Mats versus the Python guy is Guido. But when you read it, like, you know, and you just read what the guy writes, right? I'm sure he's a great guy, but the philosophy is very reflected in the language. Guido advertises himself as the benign dictator of the Python language, right?
He's Dutch too. Right. That's hilarious, man.
He's the benign dictator. Well, that's fine. A lot of people would say, well, yeah, you have to have somebody to make the final decision, right? You got to have some, otherwise things that a lot of people would share that philosophy. And then you read Mats, right? What's Mats all about? Well, programming should be happy. It should be friendly. I want to maximize programmer joy, right?
Right.
So, you know, these attitudes get reflected in the actual language, and there's room for everybody, right?
Right. So what are you most excited about right now, like in life? It doesn't have to be technology. It could be the company, technology, whatever you want. But what are you most excited about?
Oh, man, that's tough. I'm pretty pumped about Hyperloop. I mean, it seems like it's coming along, but that's technology, you know. At my age, you know, it's kind of like, hopefully most of the rapids are behind me. I'm excited about, you know, I'm in the canoe or paddling along, enjoying the scenery a little bit. That's pretty exciting.
At any point in time, you can just grab a jet engine, right, off of Amazon and just hold on to that for a minute.
Well, I don't
you
know.
You can choose.
I tell you, I am very excited, you know, getting out of my personal, it's not really my personal life, but I am so excited about, I've always been kind of a space nut. When I was a kid, I wanted to be an aeronautical engineer. And my uncle, who is an electrical engineer, said, nah, he goes, you don't want to do that. He goes, you know, you'll just end up, you go to all the school and you'll end up, you'll be doing nothing but designing the left nut on the right wheel of, you know, some jet plane, right? You know. And he said, you're not going to do what you think you're going to do in that world. He says, you should go into computers, kid. He always called me sheep for reasons we won't go into. He goes, sheep. You ought to go into computers. And he took me to a friend of his that had built an 8-bit, you know, one of these things you could punch in the front panel and load up a program. And he took me and showed me that. I got kind of interested in that. So, but I've always been, you know, fascinated with space. I'm an instrument rated private pilot. And
oh, nice.
Yeah. And I built a hang glider when I was 15. And my, you know, out of plant, I stole a book from a store. It's confession time, but I went to a store and I, you know, they had this book about hang gliding and I stole the book and then took it home and took it apart and sort of figured out how these things were designed. And then my friend and I built this hang glider and we were, you know, we'd jump off sand dunes and stuff and fly around.
Nice.
And so I've always been like planes and aerospace has been a big thing for me. So what I'm excited about, I'm just every day, like I'm seeing, what is Elon doing now? And when those two, did you watch the Tesla take off?
Oh yeah. We watch the launches.
We were basically
in our office.
We were shut down here. Right. I don't know. The production was still going, but up here in R&D, we were all just looking at our screens. My one of my sons works at the Big G Ranch there in New York City. And, my other one is a consultant in New York. We were all online chatting each other. When those two things came down, I thought, okay, that's a clip somebody made. You know, that's just an artist rendering of what it's going to look like that they're showing us, right? I thought, okay, gosh, something bad must have happened because they're just showing us this artist rendering of what it's going to look
right.
like. And you know, that's very exciting. And I got so excited about it the other day that I went and I took the size of the planets, the relative size of the planets and the sun and their distances, and I put them in a spreadsheet. And I said to my wife, you know, I want to go down to the science museum. I want to donate a bunch of money to them to put up like a display where the sun would be the size of a dinner plate, right? And it could sit on one corner of the museum, and then you could go down East Avenue in our city, and about 1,500 feet later would be the Earth, and it would be the size of a grain of rice. And then you could, and then by the time you get a mile away, you'd be at Mars, right? And there's a nice long street in our city, right? And it's a nice street to walk on. There's famous houses and museums and stuff. You could have these, and by the time you get to Mars, right? Mars is like the grain of sand, right? You know, and then the distances are just amazing. It's just so vast, and but yet, you know, this guy Elon is just turning it all upside down. Says we're going to do it. You know, we're going to do it, and he's off into space. And then there's this thing called the EM drive. Have you ever heard of the EM drive?
Oh, come on! Yeah, how can you not?
Yeah,
get out of here.
So, you know, I'm just saying, please let it be true.
He's going to make it work.
It's got to work, right? It's got to work. I think
we've all pored over schematics of that.
It just I have a godson who's a physics professor at Alfred University. And, you know, I'm always talking, he says, do you think, how could this thing work? He goes, I don't know, you know, because I'm not going to get too excited about it.
China claims to have made one.
Yeah, exactly. And now everybody's saying, well, in the Air Force probably, you know, there's all these experiments saying, I think this is the Air Force has got a satellite up, but they're just not talking about it. And
my dad was in the Air Force for many years. That's actually how he got educated in computer science to then eventually teach me, right?
Yeah.
And they were putting the first GPS system into the stealth bomber out in Air Force Base in Nellis. He said it was so cool. So what they'd do is they put him on a plane, windows blacked out, like 12 passenger plane, and then they fly you to the middle of the desert, and then it's like behind a mountain thing, like, you know, the desert rocks, they're like, I don't know, I would call them mountains if they had trees on them, right?
Yeah.
But some sort of geographical structure, and then they would work in these giant airplane hangars, and there's these lines on the ground, and you walked from hangar to hangar, you lived in one, you worked in the other, and then you'd go home on the weekend, and you really didn't know where you were, you're just kind of out in the desert, and they put the GPS into the stealth bomber.
Nice.
Yeah. And you didn't tell me that until I was 18, because that's when it was declassified.
Very cool.
Yeah.
There's also a really cool irony in that, right? That they're putting these people in a blacked out plane and hiding where they actually are, mm-hmm. while they're working on technology so that everybody can know where they are all the time.
Life is beautiful that way.
There's a great irony in that, right? Right. You are working on technology so that you can precisely pinpoint where you are on the earth, and we're not going to let you know where you are on the earth while you're working on it.
I love it.
That's beautiful.
There's been a question sitting in the back of my mind since you talked about patents and Xerox, and I believe it was either a Steve Jobs or Bill Gates interview. I was watching one of them several years ago, and they said that they went together to some large company and they actually saw like the first GUI interface, and then they both went back home and created them. And because the company wasn't really positioned, was that Xerox?
That's Xerox. That's Xerox. So when I started, that's Xerox. And there's a book called Fumbling the Future.
Yeah, that's a good name for that book.
it's called Fumbling the Future, How Xerox Gave Away the Personal Computer.
Really? That's the whole book? Oh, great.
It's a book, yeah, it's a good book. It's a well-written, readable book. So when I got to Xerox, I was an intern in 1981. You know, and that's a whole nother story, but I was the only intern at that time that Xerox had ever had, and they were hiring like crazy, that was married, because my wife and I were married while we were in college. And so, you know, we packed up every belonging we had in the back of this car and drove to Xerox, and we got there, and I had said that I was married, but of course they lost the paperwork, so they didn't know where to put us. So they put us up at this executive hotel, which, you know, it would be like, you know, my whole salary for the summer for one night, you know, so we can't stay here. Yeah. So I went to work and my wife went down to the university and found us a flop house to live in for the summer, because that was a big adventure. But
did you work on that project at all?
I'll tell you a little story on that. But when I got to Xerox, I was given, on my desk was sitting the Alto, the Xerox Alto. So what happened was at PARC, Palo Alto Research Center, where a lot of our internet technology and stuff came from, at PARC back in the 70s, they said, well, here's Moore's Law, right? Moore's Law says that by 1985, every employer, every medium size and above employer will be able to afford a computer for every one of their office workers. Okay, so that's like in 15 years. So what we need to do now is build that computer, even though it's going to cost like an amazing amount of money, but we'll build it and we'll issue it to every office worker within, like, you know, parts of Xerox and at PARC, so that we can start to learn how people would use a computer like that in an office environment. So they built this computer called an Alto, which is basically a data general, code name was Eagle. I can't remember. Data General 10. That's not right, but it's
Eagle. Sounds cooler.
Eagle was the internal code name. There's actually a great book written about the making of that computer, about, you know, all the technology nonsense that goes on and all the fun stuff while you're trying to build a product. It's written back in the 70s, I think. But anyway, so they took this data. It's very much like a PDP 10, right? And they PDP 11, PDP 10, that class of mini computer, you know, 64K of memory max, 64K address space.
Wicked fast.
And yeah, and they took that thing and they miniaturized it as much as possible, which means that it would fit like, you know, where those old school desk drawers would fit. Mm-hmm. So you could take a desk, rip out the drawers and sit this computer underneath, and the disk drive was removable, and it was a great big platter. It was about as big around as a large tray that you might, you know, for a Super Bowl game, have shrimp and stuff on. Mm-hmm. It's about that big around, and you would have racks of these above your desk. So you'd pop in the disk, and I think it had like a megabyte of data on the disk. And the screen was a great big portrait mode, pretty high res, black and white. And they were set up in portrait mode because they said, well, it's for an office and everybody looks at documents, you know, portrait. So the display should be portrait. And somebody at Stanford had developed the mouse, and they're just down the street from Park. So they said the mouse would be a great input device, so they incorporated the mouse. So that's what I had when I got there at Xerox. That was what I used. I was actually working on a C compiler for the summer because C was the new hotness, and they wanted to use C in some of their internal development. So I was porting a C compiler, but I had the Alto as my kind of my workstation. And I said, this thing is the nuts. So I went back to college. I was getting a master's degree, and I ported, you know, as much code as I could to computers I had there, so I could at least like make my thesis on a reasonably well-written editor. But that, yeah, so we had all that tech going on way back when, and so you say, well, did I work on any of that? I didn't. I was working on developing software languages, compilers, and stuff that were used in the Xerox products that they were making, because they in the 80s they was the first time they put microchips into a Xerox computer, because a Xerox printer. So before then, everything was analog. So, you know, analog controls, and so they were digitizing it. But at the time, there just wasn't any tools available to, like, even, you know, write real-time software or anything. So everything had to be done in-house. So that was the kind of group I worked in. But I do have one contribution to modern computers, right? And if you look in your, like on either an Apple or a PC, and in your device menu, you know, there's a setting that controls what's called the mouse acceleration.
Huh?
And so it basically means if you move your hand slowly, the tracking rate of the mouse is, say, X. But if you move your hand quickly, the tracking rate accelerates, so that rapid movements move the mouse farther than slow movements.
Right. It's like inertia.
Yeah, you probably just do it all the time. You don't notice it, but there's a little thing you can turn that on and off, or adjust the rate of how the acceleration is affected. So when I came back to Xerox as a full time the next year, I was issued the newest hotness, which was they'd moved on from the Alto to a box called the Dorado, was their internal name, which now had some pretty hefty compute power in it. And, you know, the first thing I wanted to do was I wanted to make it do something, right? And in those days, you know, there was no, you know, to do anything, there's no like simple APIs or anything. And so you were issued a box of manuals that covered probably the whole, you know, 10 foot above my desk was on a shelf of all these principle of operation manuals that you know, had all the APIs and everything, how this thing worked. I said, I just want to say hello world. But it was like so complex, you know, you just had to call, you know, and call and call. I just want to make it do something, right? I got this brand new toy they've given me. I want to make it do anything. So I said, all right. And I looked through and I discovered the one section had the mouse control, where you would, you know, you could read the current XY coordinate of the mouse, and then you could also write the current XY coordinate. So normally, you know, the driver's just reading it and writing it. And I said, oh, that's cool. And I said, I can do something. So I kind of played around with it, and I reversed X and Y. So you'd move your mouse one way, and it would like do the exact opposite, as if your screen was like turned sideways. So I felt good, because I'd actually made it do something, you know, with like about 10 lines of code. And, you know, I'd achieved like, you know, some intimacy with my new toy, right? But then I'd worked with these guys, you know, I knew some of them from the summer before. And so I said, oh, great. You know, so I went around that night and installed this piece of software on all their computers. So the next day they come in, and they're all like, what's wrong? I moved my mouse, it's moving in exactly the opposite way. What is wrong? What's going on? And I could hear all these shouts around, you know, it's like a QB farm, right? And I could hear all this commotion. And then, you know, about 10 minutes, everybody's in my office. And they said, what did you do? I said, what are you blaming me? So you're the only one who would do something like this. And so I said, oh, crap. So then we were kind of joking about it. But then we got to talking about it. And we said, well, actually, what could you do useful with this? And then I said, well, wouldn't it be nice, you know, the mouse and stuff? And we said, hey, that's a great idea. So I wrote a little, you know, it's like a little library, like a gem. We'd call it in Ruby, call it a gem, that would give that behavior the mouse acceleration. And then Xerox had, this is the cool thing, this was back in 1982. We had so much of what we have today was already there. Like, they weren't called the same things. They were a little bit more clunkier to use, but it was the same idea. So I released what we would call a gem into like the sort of the Xerox library of stuff. And it became popular and eventually became part of the operating system. And eventually when Apple came in and said, hey, we love this idea, can we use this technology? And the guys at Park were so frustrated with nobody in marketing was listening to them. They said, sure, take it all, have it. So my little idea is there in every computer today. That's my claim to fame.
Yeah, go Mooch. You're so, a hero.
Go Kathmandu. Let's say it right, you know.
Go Kathmandu. All day, dude.
So that's a long and very apocryphal story, but, you know, I think largely true. And but I
love it, though.
But the thing to me that was amazing that in my life, and you know, you say, what am I excited about? Well, just one thing that's exciting is just like how this has all panned out, that those seeds were all there. And, you know, and here we are, you know, many years later, and a lot of the ideas, the right ones, have evolved to be the ones that are very dominant. And, you know, and we use these things today.
That's why I'm so excited about the AR, the VR, the drones, the automation cars, like all of this stuff, because that is your mouse accelerometer, right? That is in 20 years, it's just going to be completely saturating the market and just a common thing for that generation. Yeah.
I have a little bet with myself that the car I own now, I have a 2014 Jeep Cherokee.
Oh, I have a Wrangler.
Yeah. And very nice. And my bet with myself is that that's the last car I'm ever going to buy. By the time that car wears out, we'll have autonomous vehicles and it'll just be easier to own a club membership and the car will come to you when you need it. And you get the car you need for the whatever you're doing. And so I think it'll happen within 5 years by the time I need to give up that car.
Yep, that's what I was talking about with my wife. We talk about this all the time. We have a 6-month-old baby girl.
Congratulations. Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm counting giggles and watching her eat her feed every morning. So that's the way I get to start my day. So awesome. And I tell my wife, I said, I don't think we're going to have to buy her a car. That's not going to be a decision we're going to have to make. I think the thing we're going to decide is what tier subscription of how nice the car is going to be.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think that's exactly right. And there'll be this sort of the public transport subscription, which eventually cities will just say, just like some cities have internet, right? Some cities will just say, okay, everybody who lives here gets the base tier, right?
Right.
And I bet you that I hadn't thought of that till just now. I bet you that'll happen. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming and hanging out with us, Mitch. Like, this has been, I love this conversation.
I did too. It was, we could do this all day long. You're in New York City?
We're in Florida.
In Florida? Well, yeah. I don't get down there much. Otherwise, I would say next time I'm there, we'll go hang out and have a beer. But
well, what we'll do is I'll put where you are. Where are you located right now?
Rochester, New York.
Oh, come on. I've spent so much time there. I was, really? I hang out in Buffalo, eat at Charlie's, beef on Weck, like go to the, what are the hockey team there?
Amherst and Sabres.
Yeah, go to the Sabres games. Yeah, I've spent a lot of time there.
Yeah. Well, next time you're up, you look me up
and
we'll hang out. All right.
Yeah, I think later this year we're going up through there and then up into Canada to see some of our other friends. But my wife's flying up there Saturday. We have family in Westchester. It's actually not up there.
Yeah, you're not flying up there.
Sorry.
I'm glad you understood that.
She's flying to Westchester, which is like an hour outside the city. That's not like upstate.
No, I know where it is. Yeah, I've flown in there many times. Yeah.
So. Oh, you have? Okay. Yeah, IBM's there. They're really big there.
Yeah.
If people want to find out more about you, how would they do that?
About me?
Yeah, if they want to find out more about you.
Well, they can. I don't know. They can. Sorry, I'm not very good at this answer, this question.
No worries.
I'm on LinkedIn, although I just sort of a reference page on there. You know, if you go to my GitHub, my email's on there. Mitch, M-I-T-C-H, @catprint.com. You can drop me a line.
Nice.
if you search for Robert, my actual name is Robert Van Dyne, Robert Mitchell Van Dyne, but mm-hmm. but because of your brother, I always go by Mitch or Kathmandu. But if they want to search, they can search for Robert Van Dyne Illuminati. And you will find out there's a nut job out in Idaho that has for a long time had an article about how me, my family, my dad, my grandfathers are one of the top 13 families running the world. So you can find out.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
but my handle on GitHub is Kathmandu, and you know, I'm always hanging around in the Hyperloop Gitter chat room, and so love to hear from anybody who wants to have any advice or wants to come to Rochester and be a cat coder.
Nice. Yeah, I can't wait to check out the facility. I'm gonna stop by. I'm just gonna pop in one day and be like, hey.
Oh, you should. It's from a Rails app standpoint, people are blown away that comes in here because it's the production system's fully automated. So an order is placed somewhere on the web, comes in, gets queued up, scheduled. The production people just say, okay, here's the next job you got to print. They click a button. It sends the job lays it all out, you know, does all the what's called imposition, lays it out, sends it to the press. It's picked up. There's barcode scanners that kind of track its progress through the system. And it's all run by a big Rails app.
What, Jake, we should go do a video of that.
Oh, you should. Come on up.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. So the way it works is... Thank you so much for listening to the Modern CTO Podcast. Share this, get the word out. Thank you guys so much. I couldn't do it without you. I appreciate it. You guys are the absolute best.